This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we have an interview with A.S. Byatt. The movie Angels and Insects, based on one of her stories, just came out on video. Her latest novel, Babel Tower, is about language and how it's often used to divide us. Her 1991 novel, Possession, was a surprise bestseller in the States and also won England's most prestigious literary award, the Booker Prize. Part detective story, part academic novel, part satire, it was about two scholars who are each researching a Victorian poet. The academics discover their respective Victorian poets were lovers, and then the academics fall in love with each other. The novel compared how the Victorians wrote of love with how we talk about love today. Last June, I asked A.S. Byatt what interested her in how Victorians expressed their love.
Well, they believed it mattered. I think they did have a religious sense of what love was. The religious life of Victorian England and the religious life of 19th century France, and certainly the religious life of 19th century America, was completely involved with what people thought they were, even if they were very daring atheists who were rejecting the religious frameworks. So the word love had this sort of absolute, powerful feel to it, because it also meant the love of God, and it was what human beings were for. And what I was trying in Possession to contrast that with was a sense that one of my eldest daughter once said to me, you know, about the man she lives with. She said, I know I love him, but of course we wouldn't use the word because it's become devalued. And it had become devalued, I think, by lots and lots of romantic fiction and by a kind of psychoanalytic analysing of people's emotions so that you can't say anything simply. And the Victorians, I think, were quite terrified of the love they felt, as well as in awe of it.
Have you felt comfortable using the language of love in life, or is it more comfortable to use it in literature? I mean, have you ever written passionate love letters, or is that the kind of thing you would only do in fiction form?
I have written passionate love letters, but after a time, a kind of self-parody and a kind of self-mockery gets into it, not, I think, because of the woman I am, but because of the writer I am. Because one of the terrible things about people's passionate love letters is that every single person's passionate love letter resembles everybody else's. It is not one of the areas in which you, on the whole, say something new or strange. You go down a very fine channel, and you always feel that you're the only person that's ever been there. In fact, almost everybody's been there. So love letters are quite difficult to write. It's very interesting if you read anthologies of love letters. The great ones are often written by people about to be executed, and they're really death letters, and they're suddenly somebody trying to tell somebody that they really care about them, even there, even in the tower, about to be executed. Whereas the sort of feeling of waking up and realizing, oh my God, there is somebody in my life who has become absolutely all-important to me and I can't see anybody else because they're in the way of them. It's partly wonderful, and partly it's a kind of machinery and there's an end to it. I think what I really like is writing letters to somebody you really know and love, who is interested in every little thing you think and say. But when you start saying, I love you this way and I love you that way, how do I love you? Let me count the ways, as Elizabeth Barrett Browning said. I think you quite quickly become a bit boring, at least to the writer in yourself.
Did you ever get a love letter and think, well, this is a cliche, this isn't really very interesting, the writing isn't very good?
I've had both sorts, yes. I had a most wonderful love letter from a man I didn't like at all. And what do you do about that?
What did you do about that?
I put it in a drawer and got on with my life.
Right.
But I remember the letter, you see. I remember his letter, and I can hardly remember his face.
Well, do you remember it by heart?
Well, it began with quoting a poem by Carey, I think it's Carey, one of the 17th century poets, about at last, you know, I've found the not impossible she that shall possess my heart and me. And I'd always wanted somebody to write me a letter that began with that quote, and this completely wrong man did. He was a very beautiful man, but you could see from sort of the other side of a room that he was very dangerous and not the sort of person you should ever get to know. And he drew a great big blue hand, his own hand, over this letter. I've probably still got it somewhere, but I don't know where. I never consciously threw it away. I just lost it, which is what I always do with letters.
You know what you're saying about how so many expressions of love kind of become cliché? It's very frustrating if you feel you can't rise above that, because that leaves you two choices. One is to try to express yourself and get stuck in clichés, and the other is to be mute.
Well, the third is irony, really. I was talking about Umberto Eco a bit ago, and there's a famous thing he says that bears repeating. He said, you know, in our ironic postmodern world, you can't go and say to a woman, I love you passionately, madly, deeply. He says, but you can put it in context by saying, as Barbara Cartland would say, I love you passionately, madly, deeply. He says, then the woman has been told, A, that you're far too sophisticated to utter this cliche, but nevertheless you have uttered it with your ironic disclaimer. And she knows you love her. He says, you've got it always that way. But I don't quite like doing it that way either. What I do like to do in a novel, which is why love in novels is better than life, I like love to hit people when they weren't expecting it, which is a nice thing to do in fiction.
A.S. Byatt is my guest. She has a new novel. It's called Babel Tower. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with A.S. Byatt. Her new novel is called Babel Tower. You taught English literature for, what, 11 years?
Yes, well, full-time. I've been teaching since I was about 22, either full-time or part-time, but I only taught full-time for 11 years.
Right, and so you were, I think, 48 years old when you left the university as a full-time professor to be a more full-time writer. What was the turning point there that made you think, now's the time, I'm going to do it now?
I thought it was because the government was actually paying everybody to take early retirement. And, what happened was that everybody who could do anything else, which meant that a lot of the very interesting people rushed at this money and went off and did something else and put the money in the bank. I mean, my early retirement money is still in the bank because I immediately began to earn a very great deal more by writing after one dreadful and frightening year. But I think deeper than that, I went into teaching full-time in order to pay my son's boarding school fees because I was worried about sending him to the local school. And both my husbands said, if you want him to go to a paying school, you must get a job. So I got a university post. And then he was killed the week I got the post by a car, by a drunk driver. And I stayed with the job I had taken on because it seemed, I mean, the formality of the teaching seemed a way of coping with the grief. And my youngest child was born in the January of the academic year I started teaching, and I started teaching in the September. My son was killed in the July before that. And I now see, I actually taught until my youngest daughter was exactly as old as my son had been. And that seemed to be the end of that. That seemed to be somehow the end of it.
What do you make of that? You taught for 11 years, the age that your son was when he died.
I think it was to do with my little daughter, really. I think when she got to be beyond 11, that was the end of that phase of my life, if you see what I mean. I actually think I was in mourning for 11 years, and teaching was a very good way of living because, I mean, the glory of students is that they're extremely self-centered and you have to pay them attention and you haven't got any time to have feelings about yourself. And then after a bit, I began to see that I could get back to writing more gleefully. And then I began to feel I've got to get out.
I would like you to read a paragraph from your new novel. This is from the beginning. It's not the very beginning, but it's near the beginning of the book. And this is where the main character is telling about her sister's death.
She's telling a young poet she's met by accident. Frederica tells him about her sister's death. He realizes that this narrative is practiced. This is the way she has found it convenient possible to tell it. Her sister, she says, was married to a vicar and had two small children. And the cat brought in a bird, a sparrow, which took refuge under the refrigerator, and her sister had pulled it out and reached under it, and the fridge was not properly earthed. She was very young, says Frederica. Afterwards, she says wryly, we all suffered from shock. Shock waves, she says grimly, waves and waves of shock. How terrible, says Hugh Pink, prevented from imagining by Frederica's matter-of-fact tone.
Now, I believe that you were nearly killed in the way that you just described by a refrigerator.
Yes, I was. I have a nice, neat, small, square scar on the upper part of the inside of my left arm to prove it.
What happened?
Exactly what happens in the novel. My large cat, which was called Proust, brought in a sparrow. The sparrow got on the top of a cupboard where it just sat all day. And it got to be midnight, and I said, I've got to get this bird out of the kitchen because I've locked the cat out and it can't get in. So I got on a chair and tried to frighten the bird off the cupboard, and it flew under the refrigerator. So I pulled the refrigerator out, and the side of the casing of the refrigerator sort of curved under, and the bird was standing on the edge of this. So when I pulled the refrigerator, the bird went with it. So I lay on the floor and stretched my left arm in, and it was immediately sort of burnt all the way up. The skin was burnt, and I was shaken about. The fridge was obviously not properly earthed. But my
grounded is the word we use in America, I think, just to clarify that. Yeah.
Yeah, the fridge was not properly grounded. And my ex-husband, who is nothing if not efficient, turned it off. He turned the switch off. So I was able to retreat rather shaken from under there. And the beautiful bit of this story, which never got into the novel, is that we were then living under the wall of Durham Cathedral, where the venerable Bede is buried. And Bede describes human life in terms of a sparrow, which flies in out of the dark and goes across the lighted room and flies out into the dark. And this damn bird, which was a sparrow, flew out into the dark against the wall of the cathedral under which Bede's tombstone lies. And it was a magical moment, but of course I couldn't put it in the novel, because in the novel the character was not in Durham.
Right. But so you actually succeeded in freeing the bird.
Yes, it flew away. It really flew out. It flew out and away. I don't know what it did then, because it was midnight, or by then a bit later. And I did actually think, which interested me a great deal, because I thought, I did think, this is it. I'm going to die. And then I thought, what will happen to the children? And it interested me, you know, if you talk about altruism, you always wonder how much you really would put your children first. And at that moment, I did have this complete vision of these two children sleeping quietly upstairs, and what on earth would happen to them.
A.S. Byatt is my guest. She has a new novel, which is called Babel Tower. In an interview you did for the New York Times, you said that you didn't speak to anyone voluntarily until you were about 16. And I found that really interesting, since you're so obsessed with language, the fact that you felt so uncomfortable speaking.
I used to read. I think partly the reason I was uncomfortable speaking was that I had a sort of enormous vocabulary, which until I started speaking, I assumed everybody had. You know, people used to look at me oddly when I spoke to them, because I would talk as though I was just coming out of a novel by Sir Walter Scott. Or, this is a slight joke, but it's partly a truth as well. And it's also, actually, I don't know quite where I got it from. I think my mother had a kind of social fear. I did expect to be unacceptable as a person, and I don't know where that came from.
So were you very, you must have friends, right?
Not a lot. I had one or two. Mm-hmm. And I was never quite really sure they were my friends, and I had a sort of philosophical and provisional sense that at any moment they might cease to be my friend. I had one friend who is now dead, to whom I dedicated Still Life because she was the original of Stephanie. But I don't know. I mean, I think I could also truthfully say that the life inside books was much richer and more interesting than most of the conversations you had with girls at school about crushes on other girls or hockey or what, you know, what was wrong with the teachers.
So what changed for you when you were 16 that made you more verbal?
I don't know. 16 is the right age, really. Mm-hmm. I think I spoke even less at 16. I think what made me more verbal was going to Cambridge, was going to university, was finding myself in a verbal world where lots of people, not just me, most people, I thought, cared about thinking, expected to talk about interesting, complicated things. And I thought I might not be such an oddity, and I wasn't. I mean, there were a lot of people just like me. It was It was great. And the other thing, of course, is that I did find and do find men easy to talk to, I think because my father was much easier to talk to than my mother, if he was ever there.
Mm-hmm. Your sister, Margaret Drabble, is also a celebrated novelist. Are there parts of your lives that you shared, like from childhood, that you've both written about in really different ways?
I don't think we read each other's novels. I read one of hers. I mean, I read about the first three of hers, and then I had a horrible experience, which I will describe. If you're a writer, you collect certain things which glitter at you, which you know are going to be parts of novels. And there was a peculiarly, I then thought, ugly, bright yellow vase, which moved around from room to room in the houses we lived in. And I was always going to put this vase, because I think because its proportions were wrong, into a novel. It was too bright, a yellow. And then to my horror, I found this vase sitting in a novel by my sister and saw that I couldn't have it. And this revealed to me that there would be and were all sorts of other deeper and more important things, that if I read them in her book, I would never be able to write. So we then had an agreement that we wouldn't read each other's books. I mean, we did actually sort of talk to each other about this, and we sort of thought we would. And she, when she was doing the Oxford Companion to English Literature, felt impelled to have to read The Virgin in the Garden because she was putting in my generation of writers, though not hers. So she wrote me a letter saying, I have had to read The Virgin in the Garden because, you see, I couldn't do the... and I have to tell you, I think it is a very, very good novel. And I thought it was terribly nice of her to write me this letter. but I knew exactly why she hadn't read it before. and we go along quite well but like that. I mean, there may be other vases.
I can really understand this. I really can. Though I imagine you're also dying of curiosity at the same time.
Partly. Every now and then I pick one of hers up in a bookstore and read six or seven pages to see if I come across something I recognize by accident. And I did once. I sort of came across one of her characters saying, everybody describes me as a nice woman. What can be more boring than to be described as a nice woman? And I thought, exactly. But mostly I don't. Mm-hmm. Oh, and I read a bit once where she described a woman who got out of a car into a flyover, into a motorway where you shouldn't be on foot. And I thought it was a terribly good bit of writing. But then I put the book down in the bookshop and got on with whatever I was doing.
Right. We only have about a minute left. I have one more question I want to ask you. Why have you chosen to use A.S. Byatt as your writing name instead of your full name?
It's complicated, really. It just struck me as being what you did when I started writing. I think largely because of a sort of passionate admiration for T.S. Eliot.
Mm.
And I don't think I wanted to be thought not to be a woman, but I do think that even then I didn't want to be a woman novelist, you know, with capital letters. And I think to that extent it was an attempt not at not being a woman, but at some sort of anonymity. And then in the 60s, when I had my small children and I got very gloomy and thought, you're never going to write a novel, I thought I would call my eldest daughter Antonia and she could write the novel. And this has been really a very, very silly thing to do. She's now a very beautiful woman and runs the South Bank Literature Department in London. She runs the whole literary readings there very brilliantly. And she, as far as I'm concerned, is Antonia Byatt, and I am A.S. And my grandchildren address me as A.S. They ring me up on the telephone and say, A.S., are you there? And that is how I think of myself now.
Well, that's interesting. But your full name is Antonia.
Yeah, Antonia Susan.
Oh, very interesting. I thank you so much for talking with us. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you.
A.S. Byatt's latest novel is Babel Tower. The movie Angels and Insects, based on one of her stories, has just come out on video. Our interview was recorded last June. This is Fresh Air.